This is the Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was poet laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by Gerald Stern. Gerald Stern was born in 1925 in Pittsburgh. His parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, and his poetry merges an American upbringing with his traditional Jewish heritage. In poetry collections that span more than 30 years, Stern has established a clear voice. Grace Shulman of The Nation described it this way: "He brandishes surreal images in a chatty tone. At times he is a gabby country neighbor, at others a streetwise companion, spinning out odd tales that begin with animals and move into wisdom. When he confronts horror, he is terrifying." Stern's poetry, with its everyman point of view and its celebration of place, has often prompted comparisons to Walt Whitman. Poet Kate Daniels has pushed the comparison further, calling Stern a post-nuclear, multicultural Whitman for the millennium, the U.S.'s one and only truly global poet. Gerald Stern won the National Book Award in 1998 for This Time, New and Selected Poems. His many other honors include the Paris Review's Bernard F. Connors Award, the Ruth Lilly Prize, and four National Endowment for the Arts grants. He was elected a Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets in 2006. Stern taught creative writing at the University of Iowa before moving to New Jersey, where he currently resides. Another Insane Devotion, Bolero, and Box of Cigars were recorded in Austin, Texas in 2006.
This poem is about an affair I was having when I was 22 or 23 years old with a young woman in Italy. Both of us were Americans. And we'd said goodbye in Rome already, but I couldn't stand leaving her, and I rushed up the next day to meet her again, spend one last night with her. And I was sitting outside waiting for her. And the complication of the poem is that she was married, albeit she was young, 20 or 21 years old, and her dear husband was going to arrive by train from Sicily in southern Italy on the very train that I was going to board to leave her forever and go north back to Paris. Another Insane Devotion. This was gruesome, fighting over a ham sandwich with one of the tiny cats of Rome. He leaped on my arm and half hung on to the food and half hung on to my shirt and coat. I tore it apart and let him have his portion. I think I lifted him down, sandwich and all, on the sidewalk and sat with my own sandwich beside him. Maybe I petted his bony head and felt him shiver. I have told this story over and over. Some things root in the mind. His boldness, of course, was frightening and unexpected. His stubbornness, though hunger drove him mad. It was the breaking of boundaries, the sudden invasion. But not only that, it was the sharing of food and the sharing of space. He didn't run into an alley or into a cellar. He sat beside me eating. And I didn't run into a trattoria, say, shaking with food on my lips and blood on my cheeks, sobbing. But not only that, I had gone there to eat and wait for someone. I had maybe an hour before she would come, and I was full of hope and excitement. I have resisted for years interpreting this, but now I think I was given a clue, or I was giving myself a clue, across the street from the glass sandwich shop. That was my last night with her. The next day I would leave on the train for Paris, and she would meet her husband. 35 years ago, I ate my sandwich and moaned in her arms. We were dying together. We never met again, although she was pregnant when I left her. I have a daughter or son somewhere, darling grandchildren, in Norwich, Connecticut, or Canton, Ohio. Every 5 years, I think about her again and plan on looking her up. The last time I was sitting in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and heard that her husband was teaching at Princeton, if she still was married or still alive, and tried calling. I went that far. We lived in Florence and Rome. We rode in the Bay of Naples and floated naked on the boards. I started to think of her again today. I still am horrified by the cat's hunger. I still am puzzled by the connection. This is another insane devotion. There must be hundreds, although it isn't just that. There is no pain, and the thought is fleeting and sweet. I think it's my own dumb boyhood, walking around with Slavic cheeks and burning stupid eyes. I think I gave the cat half of my sandwich to buy my life. I think I broke it in half as a decent sacrifice. It was this I bought, the red coleus, the split rocking chair, the silk lampshade, happiness. I watched him with pleasure. I bought memory. I could have lost it. How crazy it sounds. His face twisted with cunning, the wind blowing through his hair, his jaws working. Well, I actually have written several poems about the piece Bolero, the musical piece Bolero, and I have an old radio among my radios in my kitchen that actually belonged to my son when he was in high school. And I had the radio on one day, and Bolero was playing, and I was dancing in my stocking feet in the kitchen. And essentially that's what happens in this poem. Bolero. So one day when the azalea bush was firing away and the Japanese maple was roaring, I came into the kitchen full of daylight and turned on my son's Sony, sliding over the lacquered floor in my stocking feet, for it was time to rattle the canisters and see what sugar and barley have come to and how Bolero sounds after all these years and if I'm loyal still and when did I have a waist that thin and if my style was too nostalgic and where were you when I was burning alive, Nightingale? The poem Box of Cigars, I wrote in Philadelphia years ago when I was in my 20s. It's about throwing cigars that were dry and useless out the third floor window. And I felt close to the whole event because my family was in the cigar business. I felt a kind of grounding or connection with the event. My grandfather owned a small cigar factory. It had the name Stern Cigars. Box of Cigars. I tried either one or two, but they were stale and broke like sticks or crumbled when I rolled them, and lighting a match was useless, nor could I put them back in the refrigerator. It was too late for that. Even licking them filled my mouth with ground-up otter leaf, product of Lancaster or Eastern Virginia. So schooled I am with cigars. It comes in the blood. And I threw handfuls of them into the street from three floors up, and to my horror, sitting on my stoop were four or five street people who ran to catch them as if they were suddenly rich. And I apologize for that. No one should be degraded that way. My hands were crazy. And I ran down to explain, but they were smoking already, nor did I have anything to give them since we were living on beans ourselves. I sat and smoked too, and once in a while we looked up at the open window, and one of us spit into his empty can. We were visionaries.
The Jew and the Rooster Are One was recorded in New York City in 2008.
This poem, The Jew and the Rooster Are One, is a poem about Chaim Soutine. Normally he's referred to as a Russian, but he was actually Bielorussian. And he was born in a little shtetl, a little Jewish village near Minsk, I suppose. He found his way eventually to Paris. And he liked to paint bloody dead animals like Francis Bacon, the English painter. He went in hiding when the Germans conquered France,
He had a bad stomach, and ironically, he died on a table during a kind of secret operation, like one of his own animals, blood pouring out, being butchered. So the poem is about butchery in all of its manifestations. The Jew and the rooster are one. After fighting with his dead brothers and his dead sisters, he chose to paint the dead rooster of his youth, thinking God wouldn't mind a rooster, would he? Or thinking a rooster would look good in a green armchair with flecks of blood on his breast and thighs, his wings resting a little, their delicate bones exposed, a few of the plumes in blue against the yellow naked body, all of those feathers plucked, as if by a learned butcher. And yet the head hanging down, the comb disgraced, the mouth open as if we're screaming, the right front chair leg, seen from a certain angle, either a weapon or a strong right arm, a screaming arm, the arm of an agitator. And yet at the same time, the chair as debonair as any, the brown mahogany polished, the carving 19th century, the velvet green, an old velour, as if to match the plumes a little, a blue with a green. No rabbi was present, this he knew, and no dead butcher had ever been there with his burnished knife and his bucket of sand. This was the angry rooster that strutted from one small house to another, that scratched among the rhubarb. He is the one who stopped as if he were thinking. He is upside down now and plucked. It looks as if his eye can hardly contain that much of sorrow, as if it wanted to disappear, and it looks as if his legs were almost helpless. And though his body was huge compared to the armchair, it was only more horrible that way. And though his wings were lifted, it wasn't for soaring. It was more for bedragglement and degradation. Whatever else there was of memory, there had to be revenge there, even revenge on himself, for he had to be the rooster, though that was easy. He was the armchair, too, and he was the butcher. It was a way to understand. There couldn't be another. He had to paint like that. He had to scrape the skin and put the blotches on. And though it was grotesque to put a dead rooster in an armchair, his table could have been full, or he just liked the arrangement, or he was good at painting a chair and it was done first, although I doubt it. Or someone brought him the bird, a kind of gift, for food was cheap then, and roosters were easy to cook. But it was more than anything else a kind of Tartar, a kind of Jew he was painting, something that moved from Asia to Europe, something furious, ill, and dreamy, something that stood in the mud beside a large wooden building and stared at a cloud, it was so deep in thought. And it had tears in a way. There was no getting around that kind of thinking, even if he stood in the middle of the room, holding his paintbrush like a thumb at arm's length, closing one of his eyes. He still was standing in the mud shrieking. He still was dying for corn. He still was golden underneath his feathers, with freckles of blood, for he was a ripped-open Jew, and organs all on show, the gizzard, the liver, for he was a bleeding Tartar, and he was a Frenchman, dying on the way to Paris, and he was tethered to a table. He was slaughtered.
That was Gerald Stern, recorded in New York City in 2008 and used by permission of the author. You have been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with poetryarchive.org. To learn more about Gerald Stern and other Essential American poets, and to hear more poetry, go to poetryfoundation.org.